another Power Search, and I am so excited for our guest today. My goodness, she has been through all kinds of stuff, lots of twists and turns, and yet she is wonderful, and not only on top, but she's helping other people to get on top as well. And I want to bring Anna on, and Anna, you're going to have to say your last name because I know I will slaughter it.
Hi, Karen. Yes, my name is Anna Migrelishvili.
Migrelishvili.
You got it.
Whew. I have a hard time saying my kids' names, and I gave them their names. And forget remembering them. That's a whole nother issue.
Yes.
So where is the origin of your name from?
So it's Georgian, but Georgia, the country in Eastern Europe. Right. Georgia, the state where I currently reside.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I guess that could be confusing for some people. I'm from Georgia.
Yes. I'm double Georgian.
Yeah, there you go. Double Georgian. Yes. Well, you know, I just got to know a little bit about you and your story, but what I've heard is amazing. And, you know, the show is about helping people find inspiration and change their outlook on life. And I would love it if you would just start at the beginning and tell us about all these twists and turns and the fabulous things that you're doing.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Yeah, so I did not have the easiest of lives when I was growing up. And I share it now because I want to share the message that it doesn't matter where you come from and what your circumstances are, you can really change it and you can really be who you want to be. And so today's message is all about that. So my story began in Eastern Europe. My family is original from Georgia, the country, but we actually lived in Moscow, Russia for 10 years. So my childhood actually was spent as an immigrant. And if you're familiar with the story and the history, so when I was born in the late 80s, it was still the Soviet Union. And of course, in 91, the Soviet Union collapsed and all the countries became independent again. Now, during that time, it was really difficult because just economy collapsed in every single country. And so it was a lot of just craziness going on. Like you hear stories about mafia just like running the businesses, like it's completely true. We had shortage of just simple things like bread we had to stand in line for. I mean, it was just absolute craziness, right? And during the 90s, and on top of everything that was going on, Russia was at war with Chechnya. Again, if you want to look up some of the history back then. So Chechnya is located in the Caucasus Mountains, and Georgia is also in the Caucasus Mountains. And basically, most of us look the way I look. So I have dark hair, dark eyes, very specific look. Now, in Moscow, Russia, most Russians wear blue-eyed and maybe blonde hair. So I definitely stood out. And there was a lot of aggression going on toward people who looked like me because of the war. Right. So I grew up in a lot of just, you know, people just like spitting on me and calling me names. And it was just a lot of very racist attitude going on back then. It was really difficult because like I felt like I was ugly, right? Because the standard of beauty was different. And I thought that, you know, I was less than most people. Now, on top of this economical and external factors that were happening all around me, inside of my family, we were at war as well. So my father was a raging alcoholic. So he would just, you know, go on this drinking sprees where he would just abandon us as a family. So I was about 8 years old when my father would just leave like weeks at a time. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom. And I had a younger brother who was just 1.5 year old. And so I just remember at age 8, I had to go outside and collect bottles so that I could take to recycling plant to get a little bit of money and then do it multiple times per day so that I could collect enough to go and buy bread because we were just starving and my mother had to stay with my brother. So as an 8-year-old, I just felt shame and, you know, like hoping that none of my classmates would run into me. You know, I didn't have nice clothes on top of feeling ugly. I mean, it was just like all of it, right? And I turned 9, and that's when my father also began molesting me. So on top of everything, you know, now it's my father also causing me to really lose my childhood altogether, right? And so this is happening for several years. Frankly, like looking back, I just don't know how like my spirit wasn't broken after everything that I have experienced.
Right.
It was just very, very difficult. We were on the verge of becoming homeless because basically we didn't pay for rent. And the only reason why we didn't is because my grandmother sold all of her gold and jewelry to buy us train tickets. And then she eventually brought us out of Russia and back to Georgia. And then we lived in a one room apartment that she gave us. And so I think as I go through my story, you know, now that I work with the homeless, and I'll talk about it in a little bit, just growing up the way I did gives me a lot of just empathy and understanding about what's going on with people who are struggling in this country. And so it gives me, you know, a lot of compassion and passion about helping those that are less fortunate, because throughout my journey, I always had somebody who was there during a difficult time to help me. And those are the memories that I carried for the longest time. And so it's important for us as humans to be that light for others. So continuing with the story. So we moved to Georgia, and I had this interesting shift that happened. So imagine going from thinking I am ugly, I don't fit in, suddenly I'm back where I was from. And so standards of beauty are different. And suddenly I hit puberty and all these boys are just going all crazy and all around me. And I was like, wow, what's happening? Like, this is absolutely right. Crazy. So then my own family, like my grandparents, basically tell me that my future is that I will get married at age 16, and because I'm beautiful, and so that's all I amount for, is to be somebody's wife and mother, right? And so this message keeps basically telling me, like, your worth as a woman is only worthy if you find somebody who is rich. So we were a poor family. So to marry up meant like, oh, I just fulfilled my purpose as a woman. I married somebody who is rich. And so, you know, I'm a teenager, but I'm thinking, okay, so in order for me to get out of poverty, there's only two ways: marry up, like they say, or I need to really study, and education is my way out. And so I was like, I'm going to do everything that I can to get out on my own and through education. So I was really dedicated to my studies. I read a lot. Like, it was very, very different than what Georgia is like today. When I was growing up, we still had wife kidnapping going on in our country. So you probably...
Now you have to stop and explain that, because yes, I know there are people who are not familiar with the history and what that actually entails.
Yes. So wife kidnapping, I hope it doesn't happen anymore anywhere. But when I was growing up, it was happening in the Caucasus region. So where Georgia is, you know, and kind of Northern Caucasus, and then some countries like Tajikistan, so just some post-Soviet countries. So what that means, in these conservative countries, basically there was expectation that sex is a taboo, so all you cannot have it unless you're married. So you have young men with raging hormones, and they know the only way that they could fulfill their passions is through marriage. So they would take to liking a girl. They would learn her patterns. Sometimes the girl didn't even know the man. I mean, in rare circumstances, they were dating and that they would just arrange it this way so they could be together. But basically what would happen, a man would learn a girl's pattern, like what time she goes to school, what time she comes back from home. At a certain date, he talks to his friends and says, okay, on this day, we're kidnapping her. And so this unaware girl is walking down the street. Next thing you know, a car stops. Four big men get out of the car, shove her in the back seat in the middle between them, and it drives off. And then they typically would go in the direction of remote village, because basically the goal was you should not be found for at least 24 hours. If she spends the night with him, then she's no longer pure. So she's then forced to marry this man, not to put shame on her family. And so this was happening all around me. Like, I was in sixth grade when one of my classmates got kidnapped. So she was 13 when she was kidnapped. She was 14 when she had the baby, and she was already divorced by 18 because that man was beating her.
Oh, man.
And so this was all around me. So my family, you know, even though my father did all of that to me as a child, he basically was so overprotective that I would not be allowed to be outside of the house basically past 7 p.m. So I was always at home. I wasn't allowed to watch TV. So all I did was study and read. So I became very, very well read, which served me well down the road. So then I was like, okay, how do I get out of this country? And so then I hear about this exchange program that's sponsored by the U.S. State Department. And basically, if you win, you come to the United States for a year, stay with the host family. So I actually started going through the process without telling my family, because I knew they would discourage me from applying. So there were three rounds. And after the third round, I was forced to tell my family, because at that point they needed parents to sign forms because I was a minor.
Right.
It was some miracle between my mother and my grandmother. They convinced my father to let me go to the United States. And the way that they did it, they played to his ego. So, hey, you'll have a daughter who went to the United States, and this will be such a prestige for our family. So that was how they played this card. And so then I came to the United States. So I come and I stay with this amazing family. So they were much older. They had older kids. I was their exchange student number 13. So they've done it for a long time.
Yeah.
That experience was really transformative for me. And here's why. That family was the first time I've ever seen a healthy family. Everybody around me was dysfunctional.
Right.
There was so much abuse going on. It was normal. And suddenly I see a family where a woman has equal rights to a man. He listens for and cares for her. And I was like, this is where I want to be. So I knew I would do anything to come to the United States, because I just wanted to get out of my life. Really, just anything that I could do. So by the agreement of the program, I actually had to go back to Georgia. So I go back, and I couldn't come back to the United States for 2 years. So I went to university there, got scholarship. Then I got this amazing career started with the largest nonprofit. So I'm living my life, but in the middle of it, I'm like, how do I get to the United States? Because I just wanted to come. And I knew the only way I could, it was through education. I could not afford to come to start a career here. I was still broke and my family was broke. So I applied for this specific one college, because I found there was one college in the United States that if as an exchange or as a foreign student, if you applied, and you got in, you got all your scholarship paid for, room and board paid for. They got you a job. So basically, I could just literally come with a suitcase and be okay. And, praise God, I got in. And so I abandoned my life and I came to the United States. And as soon as I came to the United States, I cut ties with my father. I said, no more. I no longer have to communicate with you. And my mother, because I left, had courage to divorce him. So in the middle of it, she finally divorces my father. And that only happened because he literally almost physically killed her during one of the
nights.
It was just horrible. So back then in Georgia, domestic abuse was not considered to be a crime. So a woman really could not do much to, basically men had no consequences.
Right.
And so family abuse was not considered to be abuse. So she divorces my father, and then I have this reversal of role that happened between my mom and me, where now I'm playing the role of a protector, provider, mother, you know, and she's in this state of just, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I'm in the United States. I am working. I am studying. I'm trying to, you know, not just take care of myself, but now I have to take care of my mother and my brother, who was 7 years younger than me. So, you know, I decided wealth acquisition is my number one goal. So I decided I'm going to do business degrees. I'm going to go to sales because that's where you make money. And that was my goal. And so for many, many years, that's what I did. I just climbed that corporate ladder. I became very, very good in sales, corporate sales, made tons of money. And so I had this kind of American dream, right, that I wanted to have a nice condo, a nice car, go on fancy vacations. And so my big goal was to buy a beautiful condo in the middle of Atlanta where I live. And so I fulfilled this dream in March of 2020, years before pandemic, right? And then I also decided I'm going to completely renovate my condo and just pour in thousands of dollars because it has to look perfect. So I do that. And so I finally move into that dream that I've been working toward for years and years. A month goes by and I sit on my couch and this thought comes in my head. Well, now what? It's all this dreams and all this, oh, I'm going to be so happy once I achieve this goal, only lasted a month. And I was sitting and I said, this is unsustainable. Like, there has to be more to life. I cannot continue living my life working, saving toward another big purchase, only for it to last a month. And then I'm again disappointed, feeling like something is missing. So that really was a pivot in my mind, like, okay, there has to be more to life and I need to figure it out. So I started going through intensive therapy. So I was like, I need to go through healing. So I start going to hypnotherapy. You know, I'm just going to really heal through my childhood trauma. I'm just going to really shed the past and move toward the future and see what's going on. So as I'm going through that period, October of 2020, suddenly one night I wake up in the middle of the night and I don't know why that night was so special, but I've never ever prayed in my life before. I was atheist. I was angry with God. I said, if God allowed for all these horrible things to happen to me as a child, I don't want to do anything with God. So completely against religion, faith, everything. But that night, I said a prayer for the first time, and it went something like, God, if you exist, please tell me, what's the purpose of my life? There has to be more. Why do I keep feeling this way? So next thing, this supernatural thing happens. I hear a voice outside of myself, not inside of me, but outside, a voice in my room that says, go to the store, prepare food, feed the hungry. Just that sentence. So, of course, I freak out. I think, okay, did I dream this? Pinching myself. No, I'm awake. Okay, I need to figure this out, but I can't do it right now. It's 3 a.m. I need to go to sleep. So I go to sleep. So the next morning, I wake up and I think, oh, no, something did happen. I do need to follow this.
Right.
So I call into work. And I tell him, I'm sorry, but I can't come in today. I need to take a personal day. So I go to the store, I buy all the supplies, come home, and I prepare sandwiches and fruit and water, and I prepare this 24 bags of lunches. Pack them all, get in my car, and I was like, okay, there are homeless that I've seen downtown Atlanta, so that's where I'm heading. So go downtown Atlanta and start giving these lunches away. Every time I see somebody in the street, stop, offer them lunch, keep going. So was doing it for about an hour. And then I come across a large group of homeless hanging out together. So I park my car and I count them. And then I count the lunches and I had exact number of lunches left. And I was like, that's kind of weird, but okay. That's
a miracle, yeah.
So I take the whole big bag, walk over there and said, hey guys, just made some lunches. Would you like some? Everybody's like, yes, happy, give them all out. And I think, okay, I'm done for the day, right? Like I fulfilled what I was told. So was about to get in my car and suddenly one of the homeless ladies calls me and she says, honey, come over here. So I walk over and I said, yes, can I help you? Well, she says, I have a gift for you. And I was like, oh, okay. So she has this big bag of all of her belongings in one bag. So she's rummaging and looking for this thing. And finally she pulls this out and just gives it to me with this big smile. So I take it and it's this sparrow made of clay, this little bird. And she hands it to me and I look at it and on its chest, it was written, now in God's hands. And I just remember in that moment, I just felt like something struck my heart and I burst into tears. I got in my car and I was just like thinking only one phrase, God is real, God is real, God is real. So I just was like, God is talking to me. I have to figure this out. So I drive home and I order my first Bible from Amazon. So the Bible comes the next day. So I start reading it like cover to cover and I don't understand half of it. So I was like, okay, I need to figure it out. So then I just Google, like I would Google a restaurant, like best churches in Atlanta. So then pick a church based on reviews and just start going to church. So I kept going for probably almost a year before I was like, okay, now I truly understand what it means to be a follower of Jesus. I'm ready to commit. I understand that my life is not just about me. So I got baptized. Well, here's an interesting thing. And I think God, this is, you know, back to my comment, how God has always placed people to help me along this my journey. When I was back in the United States as a student, I got matched with a host family. So as an international student. So my host family ended up being, my host father was a pastor of a Baptist church and my host mother works for a missions organization. And so they gently tried to introduce me to Jesus for years and I was not having it. Like they were, and they've been praying for me for over 10 years.
Oh, and,
you know, like they were already thought like she's living her life, like she's never going to change. Like she just loves her comfort, her, you know, job, her security. And next thing I know, this happens. So when I decided to get baptized, I actually drove back to Kentucky. That's where I went to college and where they live. And so my host father was the one who baptized me. Isn't that the sweetest how God just arranged for the whole thing? I thought that was just so, so beautifully crafted.
Oh, so yeah.
Yeah. Very, very emotional for both of us because, you know, we've been, they've been like my family here in the U.S. for over 10 years. And then I realized like there was this invisible wall between us that suddenly fell down after, you know, I accepted Christ. So it was just very, very beautiful. So anyway, so then, you know, things start shifting in me. I realize that my corporate career doesn't give me fulfillment anymore. Like I wanted to do something that would leave this earth a better place. And I just didn't feel like selling whatever I was selling was doing that. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And it was kind of scary to think about like quitting my job, but I was already kind of thinking about, I need to really take a sabbatical. So I was planning on taking like a few months, maybe from the summer till the end of the year. So that was already in my head. Well, then unexpected thing happens. So it's January 31st, 2022. And I wake up and my phone is blown up. Just messages, calls, unknown numbers. Like, I'm like, what is happening? Well, it turns out my family back in Georgia in Eastern Europe is in national news because my 82-year-old grandfather stabbed his own son, my uncle, 30 times in his sleep. So, yes. That was my
mouth wide open. Oh yeah. My gosh.
Yes. And so, and this is, you know, just culmination of this generational trauma that got passed on. My grandfather was extremely abusive toward his children. And then my uncle grew up. And when my grandfather became old, they switched roles. The abused became abuser. And my uncle started abusing my grandfather. And so at some point, he basically snapped. He could no longer take that abuse. And so he just killed his own son in his sleep. And so, I mean, it was just like, I felt it was surreal. Imagine I'm watching the news. It's the balcony where I, like, I've spent so many days, right? It's the knife that my grandfather used to cook with. There's my grandfather is in handcuffs and they're interviewing. I mean, it was just horrible, horrible. And I'm just thinking, like, what life was he living if he chose to take such a sin upon his soul to kill his own son rather than continue living, right? It's just horrible. But that was kind of that final straw where the next day I went into work and I put in my 2-week notice. I said, I gotta do this because tomorrow is not promised. I don't know what's gonna happen. So I have to have no regrets. So I quit my job. For the first time ever, I did not work. So I was like, what do I do? And I realized that my entire life, I only worked for the purpose of money acquisition. I never worked because I enjoyed it. I never knew what is it that I'm passionate about? What is it that I want to do? So it was almost like I started learning myself for the first time. Not having to rush, right? Not having this crazy life that we live in the United States and suddenly having the time freedom. So I thought about it and I said, I'm going to start by healing my past. So I actually went back to Georgia and I decided that I'm going to fall back in love with my culture because I was resentful of it for my entire life. But then I decided you cannot really truly love yourself unless you accept where you come from. So, and that was amazing. And I decided I'm going to travel the world. I actually put my condo up for sale, that beautiful condo I worked for years. I said, Lord, take me anywhere. I'm willing to relocate anywhere in the world, whatever door you opened. Like, I have nothing that holds me. I just want to follow your guidance. So my condo is up for sale. I planned my trips. And so it was really interesting. I was going to go on all these trips by myself, just kind of exploring. But I ended up going to only one trip by myself. And that was to Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. I wanted to visit all the holy places and really grow in my faith. And because all my friends, family members, when they found out I was doing it, this year of sabbatical, suddenly everybody wanted to jump in and travel with me. So I ended up just going on these trips with friends I have not gone on trips with. So it was just really beautiful bonding experience that entire time. So then, you know, my condo has been up for sale and then it fell through at the closing table 3 times with 3 different buyers. And that was a hot time, hot market for sellers in Atlanta. And I had just like a very unique condo in Atlanta. And my, even my realtor is like, this is really weird. Like the reasons why it falls through. And I was like, okay, this is God telling me I have to come back to Atlanta.
Yeah, so, you say God's telling you, come yes. home and stay in your condo.
Yes, exactly. So I was like, okay, I hear you. So I cut my travel short, pull the condo off the market, and come back to Atlanta after about 6 months. So then I decided I'm going to start going on silent retreats. I wanted to experience what a silent retreat would feel like. So there's this one monastery in Kentucky called Abbey of Gethsemane, and it's beautiful. So I booked a 5-day silent retreat there. So I go. And if you've never experienced a silent retreat, it's basically you don't talk the entire time. Nobody talks. You don't have any cell phone, any communication with the outside world. And you really spend that time in prayer, meditation, just walking and just really quieting and going deep inside of you and really figuring things out, right? Because my goal was still to figure out what is my purpose? Why I'm on this planet? So I go and suddenly I start, like I brought my laptop, but I didn't have it connected to Wi-Fi, but I just started just writing. And I wrote my book in 2 days while at that monastery.
And that's Finding Courage to Change, right?
Finding Courage to Change, yes. And so the title came from the vision. My book cover came from the vision that I got during that stay. So it was almost felt like this download that happened. And so all the things that I've covered, I've talked about in this book, but I also started talking about generational trauma. So I talk about 4 generations on my mother's side and 3 generations on my father's side. And I talk about how the history repeats itself. Basically, abuser abuses somebody, that's somebody who's abused becomes abuser down the line, and so on. And the cycle just continues, right. continues until you have a cycle breaker. And so that was me for my family. And I said, no more. And so I talked a lot about just my healing journey and just different experiences that I've gone through. And so it was obviously very healing for myself. But then in prayer, I started asking God, okay, Lord, like, is this something that you wanted me to write just for myself? And the answer was clearly no. This needs to be written so that right. other women can read it. Because what ends up happening as a survivor of child sexual abuse, there's actually, it's a taboo topic a lot of the times. And a lot of the survivors feel very alone and isolated because they feel like they're the only ones who've experienced it, which we know is not true. It's 1 in 4 women go through that as children in the United States. And so, you know, I am strong enough to talk about it. I'm strong enough to share this story with other survivors so that they don't feel alone and they feel like, it's okay, like I can go through this traumatic experience and I can thrive. I don't have to be in the survivor mode.
Right.
So I said, okay, never in my life I thought I would be an author. That's not something I've ever dreamed of or thought of, right? And suddenly I have this book. So then I was like, okay, Lord, like, do I need to start sending it to publishers? Do I need to figure out how to publish it myself? And God is like, well, how about option C? And he says, you don't need to do anything. All you have to do is share this with people you meet. I'm going to send somebody who's going to help you. But okay, interesting. So this is October. February, I have coffee with a acquaintance and tell her the story. And she says, oh, well, we're going to this networking event upstairs. And I'm going to introduce you to my friend. She helped me publish my book. So she can help you. And so that's exactly what happened. I had to do nothing except talk. That person came into my life. She helped me put it all together. And the book was published like 4 or 5 months later. So exactly how it was told, how it happened. So that's my first silent retreat. So then it's December and I'm still not sure what's my purpose. So I was like, okay, this silent retreat is specifically like, Lord, tell me what I'm supposed to do next. So I go again for 5 days to a different monastery. So this time, like, it's quiet. Nothing is happening the entire time, like just nothing. So then it's the last day before I leave the next morning. And it's my last prayer session. It's like 9:30 p.m. And I was like, okay, Lord, like, I don't hear anything. I don't know what you want me to do. I guess I'll go back to sales and then see what happens. And so next thing I know, there's like this vision I get, and it's this business plan. It's like, this is the program, how to help homeless, how to solve homelessness in this country. This is how to do it. There's like this newspaper articles. Like, I see myself on stage talking about it. And it's like, I don't know how long it lasted, but it was like overwhelmingly big, right? To the point where I just started sobbing and overwhelmed. I was like, Lord, I can't do this. Like, who am I? Like, I don't have connections. Like, I'm not even, like, I don't even have a lot of Christian friends. Like, I just became Christian 2 years ago. Like, I don't know how I'm supposed to do this. Like, no, I can't do this. And I was just like, this is so big. Like, how would I do it? But then I started thinking, okay, so if this was a five-year plan, how would I get there, right? Let's break it down into small actionable items to get to it. So I said, okay, I need to build my Christian circle first. How do I do that? Okay, let's Google Christian meetups, Christian networking organizations in Atlanta. And I really couldn't find something that met consistently. And I was like, I'm going to start my own. So I started Christian Professionals of Atlanta. So literally less than 2 weeks later, everything was official, LLC filed. And so started planning our first event. It was February of 2023 when we had our first event. So then started meeting every month. And so we have this community that just comes together. So the first year we had 500 people who've come through our events.
Oh, wow. And
suddenly I went from nobody knows who I am to somebody who's kind of coming to the map of, okay, she's a Christian leader in this city. So some other Christian leaders start talking with me. So, okay, there's something happening, right? So I said, okay, so next step is for us to rebrand. We are good with Atlanta. Let's start thinking about growing and starting new chapters. So when I first started Christian Professionals of Atlanta, I went ahead and purchased Christian Professionals of America name, because in my vision, I only saw kind of the headlines for the US.
Right.
But then first request to start a chapter came from Brazil. So I was like, okay, so I guess maybe it's not just America, maybe it's just worldwide. And so that's there for a new name was born, Christian Professionals Network Worldwide. And so the beginning of the year was really all about rebranding. So new name, new logo, you know, website, all of that stuff that needs to happen for you to really start franchising a concept. So it's May of this year, and I never make any decisions until I seek God's guidance.
Right.
So yet again, I go on my silent retreat. So this time I'm at the silent retreat and I'm like, okay, Lord, like, where should I start the new chapters? Like, guide me. Like, what am I supposed to do next? And the message that I get is like, now is not the time for expansion. Now is the time for foundation. And I said, okay, I guess it's not a five-year plan. I need to start working on it now. So I come back, come with my advisor team and say, okay, we're starting the nonprofit now. So we're pausing the expansion plan. We're starting the nonprofit. So within 30 days, I kid you not, we had everything done, including first fundraiser. We got our IRS approval for nonprofit status in 2 weeks. Typically, wow. Like 3 to 6 months. Like, I could not believe it, right? And so I was like, this is God's favor. Like, there's no other way why we would get something this fast. Well, then a few days before our fundraiser, this big news comes out in the US. Supreme Court passes legislation making homelessness punishable by law. And so I was like, oh, this is why you wanted us to start as soon as possible, because you don't know children to be put in jail.
Right. So for something that's clearly not they're doing.
Yes. Yes. And so I was like, okay, so this work is really crucial. So let me kind of talk about everything that came with the foundation. So the entire time, right before we started the foundation, I was doing a lot of research. I knew nothing about homelessness in the United States. So I really started ground up. I started volunteering. I started meeting with the homeless. I started meeting with all the different large homeless shelters in Atlanta. And this is what I've learned. Number one reason why people become homeless is what's called relational poverty. That might be a new term for some of you, but basically what it means, you have lack of genuine connections in your life.
Right.
And this was a aha moment, because when I've spoken to many people thinking and asking them, why do you think people become homeless? Most of the time, the picture that they get in their head is somebody on the side of the street who is either mentally ill or has a drug or alcohol abuse issue, which that's actually what's called chronically homeless. And in Atlanta, it's only about 14% of the overall homelessness.
So wow, that's not very much.
No, it's not. So actually the majority of the homeless is what's called unseen homelessness. It's families and people who live in their cars, extended hotels, hotel stays, or at homeless shelters. So you and I would not typically meet them because they're not in the street, but yet they're
right. Right.
So in Georgia, we have 10,000 homeless, and we've had 10,000 homeless in 2017, and we still have about 10,000 homeless in 2023. So the needle is really not moving. So then I started asking, like, what's happening? Why? So I started looking at how do homeless shelters operate? And majority of them, rightfully so, focus on immediate physical needs of the homeless. Safety, right. Shelter, food. Many of them actually focus on also giving them opportunities for jobs. So they do some training. They, you know, have some partnerships with corporations, and they really try to get them back on their feet with the job. Right. But the problem is that they're still in that low income kind of paycheck to paycheck lifestyle. And so what ends up happening, the recidivism rate is pretty high. It could be between 30 to 70% of people who get out of homelessness within 5 years will return to homelessness. So what happens in this country, we have 34 million Americans right now living on poverty line, meaning paycheck to paycheck. And so, you know, something unexpected can always happen. Car breaks down, health issue, you lose your job unexpectedly. They have no savings. And so what typically determines who will become homeless and who does not is whether they have family, friends, faith community around them to help them in that hard time. If they don't have anybody, they become homeless. They don't have any other option. Right. And so these are people who just had really difficult circumstance that has caused them to experience that. So then I said, okay, 30 to 70% is pretty high. And this is because the relational poverty piece is not fixed. It's fixing physical needs, but not that piece that's causing the homelessness. And then I come across this particular homeless shelter that has only 10% recidivism. And I say, well, what's different? Why is it so much better than the others? Well, the difference was that the structure of it was more as a community. So it was a campus that provided childcare, and there was church, and there was this, you know, just different groups and medical facilities. So everything was really community oriented. And so that resulted in a much higher success rate for people who get out to never return. So then it all made sense why this business plan of having mentorship program just makes sense. Right. And so think of like Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America. That's a very well-known mentorship program in our country, but it's specifically for youth.
Right.
They have a very high percentage of success rate of people getting out of poverty if they go through this mentorship program. So we already know mentorship programs work to get out of poverty. So why not apply the same concept to the homelessness? So this is our goal, is to basically find as close to 10,000 mentors as we can with every single homeless person who wants a mentor in this city. Because what we believe, once they go through the program, in addition to all the resources that the homeless shelter provides, they can really thrive and they don't return. So our goal is to have that 10% or less recidivism as they go through our program. Most of them don't have even one emergency contact. Our goal is for them, by the time they're done, for them to have three emergency contacts. So it's one-on-one mentorship. We really encourage them to start, join a faith community, because faith community really supports you as you go through a hard time. Right. And then also, once they get a job, we give them membership in our networking organization so that they can now start coming in and meeting other professionals and have more job opportunities within our network as well. So our first cohort is actually launching in January with Nicholas House, which is a homeless shelter here in Atlanta. And we're already pretty much outgrowing their need. So we're already partnering with the second homeless shelter here in Atlanta. So the goal is really in 2025 for us to prove this concept, show the statistics that this works, so that we can really get more awareness and more funding so that we can start replicating this with basically every major homeless shelter, first in Georgia and then move to other major cities in the United States. So the goal is really to be in 10 years in 60 major cities with the networking organization and with the foundation together working, because the networking really feeds us through with the mentors, because we have all these new professionals coming in and we're letting them know about what we're working on. And so this has been a really big mission. What I thought was going to be a 5-year plan turned out to be done in a year and a half, right? Like I always started the foundation in a year and a half. And so, yeah, so we are kind of in this growth trajectory. We hope to continue. We hope to help more people. So that's the story.
What an amazing story. And what an inspiration. And you know, to go from being an atheist to actually having God talk to you and you listening, because often we're spoken to and we don't hear it because we're choosing not to listen. And the fact that you chose to listen and, you know, your book, Finding Courage to Change, I think that's amazing. Because you found a lot of courage and you did a lot of changing in your life to survive and thrive. Mm-hmm. And so that's amazing.
Thank you.
What can we, the listeners, do so that we can also help with your homeless internship and and with the other things that you have going on?
Absolutely. So if you go on our website, cpnworldwide.com, go under our foundation, and we definitely need more funding to grow. We need to create a big training program for 2025. If you're currently located in Georgia, we need more mentors. So you can definitely sign up to become a mentor. If you're in another city and if you want to start a chapter of the organization, we're looking for partners to launch new chapters in other states. All so right. Definitely go under the tab to start a chapter and reach out, and we will schedule a meeting with you. We really want to build awareness around this mission, and this is something innovative and new. And so you have an opportunity to really be part of something big that's growing and make an impact on our country.
Oh, that is so awesome. And I want you to take a little bit of time, if you will, and tell us a little bit more about your book, Finding Courage to Change, because I feel there's a whole lot more to it than came out. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So I go in more detail about just different trauma responses. So one of the things that I've learned as I talk more with the survivors is that I hear the same message, like, I don't understand what's wrong with me. Why do I keep doing this or that? But through a lot of just healing work and a lot of different types of therapy that I've done, I've learned that a lot of it is actually a trauma response and not necessarily who you are or, you know, so we need to really learn how to separate our identity from our trauma. So I'm going to give you an example that's very personal to me, and I think that will provide a context for what I'm telling. So for most of my life, I did not want to have children. And I logically explained that to myself. I am just not that type. I don't want to change my lifestyle. I don't want to pass on my father's genes. Like all this logical explanation. I've even gone to therapy specifically for that, thinking like, I have fear of pregnancy. Like what's going on? And the answer was always like, nope, I'm just not meant to go through that. Well, about 3 years ago, I had this breakthrough in therapy where it was almost like a switch that like just was flipped and turned on. And suddenly I wanted to experience motherhood just like that, from going, you know, no, most of my life, to suddenly wanting to be a mother. Now, I'm not sharing this story because I believe every woman has to be a mother. That's not my point at all. Right. But my point is that trauma was the thing that was keeping me from experiencing something so beautiful. And I had no idea. I logically explained to myself, I thought this was me making a decision when all along it was my trauma response. Right. And so imagine if something so big can be impacted by our past, like how important is it to heal? And so I share all these details because I want women who've gone through to see a pattern that this is really not me. This is the trauma that's causing it. I mean, like a lot of the time I hear things like choosing wrong men, promiscuity is one of the side effects, alcohol and drug abuse, depression, lack of memories from your childhood. So there's all these signs that when I get to know a woman, I was like, oh, she's gone through something. And an interesting thing was I've been friends with so many women for years, and I never.
I'm so sorry.
What a problem. Bless you. Bless you.
I held it, but it wouldn't stay. Anyway, go ahead. You've been friends with these women
for many years, and I never shared my story until my book was published. And suddenly, I start learning that there are women in my friend group who've gone through the same thing. And yet we would never have shared that if not for me having the courage to talk about it first. And so I had the privilege of being a keynote speaker for a organization called Sapria, and they fight child sexual abuse worldwide. And I shared my story, and it was a very short 10-minute speech. And afterwards, I probably had 5 or 6 women who came up to me and said, me too. I've gone through that. And the more I talk about it, so many more women and men came to me and shared their story. I've had a man in his 60s. We had a business meeting and he shared about something that happened to him when he was a child. And he said, this is the first time I've ever shared it.
Right.
But the sharing is the part of healing. So one of the most important things as part of healing is sharing your story and having a community. Having a community of survivors actually helps in your healing journey. And so if any of you have gone through it, I highly recommend for you to go to sapria.org. I'm actually going to put it in the chat, because they offer free 4-day retreats for women who've gone through child sexual abuse, and it's completely free of charge. I've gone through it myself, and it was one of the most incredible experiences. You can apply, and it's, again, completely free to survivors. So it's a great resource for healing.
Oh, that is wonderful. One of the things that I have found that have... people who have gone through a lot. I mean, some people wear what's happened to them as a badge of honor. I am, I have, I was. And others say, yeah, it happened, but I am me. I am a survivor. I am, instead of wearing their trauma as a badge of honor.
Yeah.
And what would you say to somebody who wears it as a badge of honor, or maybe doesn't even know they wear it as a badge of honor, that there's so much more that they can have in life?
Yeah. So the way I look at my trauma, and hopefully that will help you, is it happened. It made me stronger in who I am today. And I don't want that darkness to be purposeless. I want it to have a purpose. And so I talked about it for the point of saying, I have gone through it, I survived it, I thrive it, and let me help others, let me pull them up so they don't feel alone and they know that they can also go through whatever they went through and they can be okay. And you can go through all this healing, you know, and all this just... I guess if you wear this as a badge of honor in the sense that, you know, I'm a victim, then you're giving power to your abuser.
Right.
And we want to take that power away from that abuser. I know it's very unfortunate. A lot of the times we as survivors have to carry it for the rest of our lives. And to be honest, one lesson that I've learned is that healing is a journey and it's never ending. It's really about looking back and seeing how much progress you have made versus it's not a destination that you can reach at some point and suddenly you're magically 100% healed. And so you can choose to be a victim and say, why did this happen to me? Or say, this happened to me. I'm not going to give that abuser any more of my power and I'm going to figure out how to heal myself. And so I've done all kinds of different types of therapies, and from regular therapy, one of the things that really helped me with my PTSD is a type of therapy called EMDR.
Yes.
It's used a lot with the veterans, but it helps a lot of people who've gone through any type of childhood abuse. It doesn't have to be just sexual. But basically what it does, it separates your identity from your trauma. And so now I'm able to actually talk about anything that's happened to me in my childhood without getting emotional about it, without getting upset about it. And so I highly recommend that particular type of therapy. And then later on, I've gone through hypnotherapy, and that helped me with the anger. So anger stage is the longest one. Typically on the healing journey, it's really difficult to get out of that stage as somebody who've gone through something really horrific.
Yeah.
And so I had that toward my father. And so, but you carry it and it's this heaviness that you don't even realize you carry until you get rid of it. And so I've gone through a lot of that, and it's not an easy process. I mean, I remember when I was going through therapy, I would take naps every day because I would just like be tired all the time because it's work.
Wow.
But I'm so grateful that I invested in myself, because I just would not have been my full potential that I am now if I didn't go through all of that.
Well, and you wouldn't have the understanding to help others that need somebody as an example and that need a mentor or coach to help them get beyond it. I had a gal I worked with that, and a great boss. I had a great boss and a wonderful lady that I worked with, but she was miserable. And I mean her personality and her attitude, because she just was not nice to people. And I say that now because she really was a lovely person. But finally, the boss said, you know, we can't have this in the office. Something's got to change. And she broke down and cried and talked about how she'd been abused as a child, and went on and on. And he said, well, you know, you're going to have to go and confront your father. And she said, I can't. He died 10 years ago. And I'll never forget her telling me the story, because Robert stopped and looked at her and he said, you mean to tell me you are allowing that man to reach up out of the grave and continue to victimize you, and he's not even here? And she said, reality hit that I was miserable in sharing my misery with everybody else, because mm-hmm. I was allowing this person that no longer lived to continue to victimize me, instead of saying, you know what they did really sucked and was bad and awful, and I won't let it dictate who I am.
Yeah. And it's not an easy process. Listen, I don't underestimate what you experience as a child can really break somebody. But it's a journey. And I just want to encourage every listener, if they've gone through something like this, to really invest in healing, however that looks for you. Because even though her father was dead, in therapy, she could have still done a role play where she still is able to tell, because I never was able to tell my father in person right. what I felt. But in therapy, I was able to basically get out everything that I was feeling. And so it's a helpful exercise. You can even do it if you can't afford therapy, you can do it at home. Put a right. chair. Imagine that your abuser is sitting in that chair, and just tell them exactly how you feel and everything you've ever wanted to tell them.
Yeah. Well, that's what she did. She didn't do therapy. She went to his gravesite and just let him have it, told him everything he had done and how it made her feel. And she just let it, and it was therapeutic in a way that I wouldn't have imagined, because, you know, we've all go through our things, but man, I didn't go through anything like that. And it was, she just said, yeah, I had to just basically spit on his grave, not physically, but metaphorically,
right.
and to let it all out. And I think that's important, that we remember that holding it in and pretending it didn't happen, or holding it in and being ashamed, and it must have been my fault. If I'd been better behaved, if I had looked prettier, if I had been taller, if I had whatever, that we hold that in. And absolutely. that is damaging. And it, you know, having you help people and understand that there are ways to deal with this and to confront it and to do it, and going back to your book, Finding Courage to Change, is a very courageous thing for these people to let go of trauma, no matter how big or small it may seem to somebody else. To them, it's trauma, and it's absolutely. Something they have to deal with, going through.
Yeah. One thing is, you never want to compare your trauma to anybody else, because two people could experience exact same trauma but have completely different response. So it's very individual, and it really depends on you as a person. So that's one right. thing. Second is, specifically for child sexual abuse, on average, it takes a survivor over 25 years to even verbally say that that's happened to them. So you keeping it in is actually not helping you. So first step is to vocalize that that happened to you. And third statistics is that almost 50% of people who've gone through child sexual abuse become abusers themselves. And so to me, that should be a alarming statistic for us to really, as a society, work toward prevention. Because if we prevent it, then we basically start reducing the rate at the same time. And more adults need to go through healing so that then they don't become abusers.
You know, amen. I mean, that's spot on. Amen. And nothing more I can say about that. Jace, put up her website again. And Anna, I'm going to tell you, I am impressed, inspired, and motivated by what you've been through, what you've done with it, your willingness to listen to, you know, the spirit in doing what it is that you need to do, and the courage to find your purpose and then begin to fulfill your purpose. Okay. And I encourage all the listeners to go ahead and look up their website, find what you can do to help with the foundation, be a mentor or coach, start a new chapter in your area. There are just so many things that you can do. And people need people. And you need, and by you, I mean each one of us, we need somebody that we can help, as well as we need to allow others to help us. Amen. And yes. So it's twofold.
Absolutely.
So, well, Anna, your story has been amazing. I want everybody to go out and get your book, Fighting Courage to Change. Because, man, if courage is one thing that you've got a hundredfold. And I really appreciate that. And all of you listening, I know that you have changed just by listening to Anna's story today. And I just want you to know that I love you and I adore you and that life is meant to be happy. And so let's do everything we can to find happiness, however we have to go about it. That being said, don't forget to join us again next week for another Power Surge at Wednesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget to join on Karenisms on Mondays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And Anna, again, thank you so much for being on the show today. And everyone, mwah, ciao for now.
Thank you.